Nu beginnen, nu beginnen, nu beginnen. Overnieuw, 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 nu. Wacht.
Zeg start.
Oké, okay, start.
Hij moet start zeggen zometeen.
Oké, okay, nu. Start.
My heart is sad and lonely. For you aside. For you dear only. Why haven't you seen it? I'm all for you, body and soul. I'll spend my days in longing and wondering why it's me you're wronging. I tell you I mean it. I'm all for you, body and soul. I can't believe it, it's hard to conceive it, why you threw away romance. Are you pretending it looks like the ending? Unless I could have one more chance to prove this. My life, a wreck you're making, it's a wreck. You know I'm yours, just for the taking. I gladly surrender myself for you. Bye. I can't believe.
sick to death of hearing things from neurotic psychotic short-sighted politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I'm sick to death of reading things by stupid little punk rockers. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I'm a short-sighted yellow belly and a drinky dicky. Death of hearing things from paranoid schizophrenic mama's little chauvinist. All I want is the truth. Just give us the truth. I'm sick to death of hearing things from stupid little socialites lying and grimy hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give us the truth. Those shorts and the yellow bellies and the trippy dickies gonna mother her but stop so. Just a pocket full of hope. Money for them.
You'll never get anywhere if you try to read me. You think it's love when fingers touch. I think that you think too much. 'Cause really, me up. I don't wanna miss this.
vandaag luister je weer naar een uitzending van een godverdomme, godvertering, kutpatapoe.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. It's great to see so many people. I think it's always a pleasure to have so many interested people coming for interesting lectures. And I can understand because our guest of honor, Sergei Lebedev, is here. The title of his speech, you see it here, After Putin, Russia's Imperial Complex as a Cultural and Political Problem. He will give his lecture in a few minutes. First, let me introduce myself. My name is Kisha Hekster. I work for the Dutch public broadcaster, and I was a Moscow correspondent for a few years, but it's already a long time ago. I'm based now in Brussels, where I cover EU and NATO, among other things, but I think everybody who's involved in Russia shares with me that you can never get it out of your mind. So it's a great honor that I'm your guide for this evening again. Thank you so much, Raam, for asking me, and De Rode Hoed for organizing this 8th October lezing. Before we ask Sergei Lebedev to hold his lecture, he will be briefly introduced by famous filmmaker Jessica Gorter. I will give you the floor a bit later. And after the lecture, there will be a Q&A. I will ask Sergei some questions over here. And then afterwards, it's your turn, esteemed public, to ask your questions to Sergei Lebedev, so you can already start thinking what's the most pressing question you have on your mind. Let me think what I forgot. Not too much. Today, I think Jessica, please come over here. You all know Jessica Gorter, I guess. She's a famous filmmaker, documentary maker, and also board member of RAM. So we're very happy that you're here to introduce Sergei. And I learned that you met in Russia. And can you explain what you were doing there at that moment?
Yes. So thank you. It's a great privilege to introduce Sergei Lebedev to you. And we met in 2018 in the apartment of Yuri Dmitriev, the historian researcher who was looking for mass graves until he himself was arrested. But in the week that we met, he was still he had already been arrested, but he was allowed to await his verdict at home.
And you made a great documentary about him, and through this documentary, you met Sergei, and you're going to introduce
him. Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, I'd very much like to share an anecdote from my first meeting with Sergei in Yuri Dmitriev's apartment in March 2018. The room we were in was filled with family, friends, and journalists from independent outlets like Novaya Gazeta, Radio Liberty, and BBC Russia, all aware it might be our last chance to speak freely with Dmitriev. The next day, he would face the verdict of an unfair trial with fabricated charges that would most likely result in a lifelong prison sentence. Sergei pulled me aside that evening, and he told me about a video recording that Dmitriev had shown him the night before. Dmitriev had filmed himself with a small camera during his last exhibition to the Solovki Islands in search for unmarked graves of prisoners who perished during the Stalin times. In the image, he primarily focused on the ground in front of him, zooming in on all small details of the soil, talking softly to himself about what he was observing. Sergei clearly was very excited about this material, and he urged me, "You must ask him about it, and you must see it, and you can maybe use it for your film, as it reveals how he searches, how he looks, and how he meticulously examines the earth for clues that can help him in his quest finding these people." Back in the Netherlands, I read Oblivion, Sergei Lebedev's first novel, which explores the legacy of the Soviet Union's Gulag. I had not read anything like it before that connects the unresolved violent past so vividly with the present one. The dark phantom of the past haunting modern Russia became almost tangible. And I suddenly understood why Sergei had drawn my attention to the seemingly insignificant video footage. These images showed Dmitriev utilizing every detail to unlock the past. It became very clear to me what both men share. Layer by layer, they uncover history with all the resources and talents available to them. Both are driven by an unrelenting determination and courage to confront their country's concealed past, where every trace of the perpetrators seemed to have been erased. The fact that Yuri now has spent almost 8 years in prison and Sergei decided to leave his country in 2018, speaks volumes about their bravery with which they do their work. Sergei is remarkable for his willingness to explore all sides of his own family history. Through extensive research, which he has conducted for years and likely continues to do so, he has uncovered a lineage of merchants, priests, and nobility, most of whom perished during the First and the Second World War in the Siege of Leningrad or in the Gulag. He also discovered that his grandmother's second husband was a colonel in the State Security Service and head of a Gulag camp. In his books, he writes about the pain of not knowing, the struggle with guilt, shame, fear, and deep sadness, and how these often subconscious feelings deeply affect modern Russia. He confronts Russians with their repressed past, and he invites his readers to examine their own history and reflect on themselves. He offers us a perspective on what is happening in Russia, but besides helping us to get a better understanding of the current situation and providing context for what is happening, Sergei is a great literary talent. The New York Review of Books praised Lebedev as the best of Russia's younger generation of writers. And next year, his latest novel, The Lady of the Mine, will be published, detailing the early stages of Russia's aggression against Ukraine in 2014 and the downing of flight MH17. It is high time we get to know him better, as his books have been translated into 20 countries, but not yet here in the Netherlands. So we are very honored to have him here with us. Let's give him a warm welcome.
Dear ladies, dear gentlemen, Jessica, all who made this trip possible, many, many thanks. It's a great honor to stay here. I was actually really surprised by the venue. We are in a hidden church, and I would say that in some sense we are a hidden church. We are preaching the values which are at stake today: freedom and justice. So let be it. I will start. We are speaking today as we approach the end of the third year of Russia's open military aggression against Ukraine, which the Russian leadership mockingly calls a special military operation. Ukraine's losses, military, demographic, economic, cultural, are staggering and growing by the day. At the same time, the hopes that the Russian aggression would run out of steam, that the economy would fail, that there would be a social explosion, unfortunately, did not materialize. The Russian state proved to be stable enough to continue the war without considering losses. Of course, one could say that the reason is that all opposition structures have been destroyed in advance and that coordinated, sustained public protest is impossible under de facto military dictatorship and police state. This obvious consideration seems to be important, but incomplete. There is another factor that lies at the intersection of social and ethical, a factor that is difficult to measure empirically, but that plays an important role in both Vladimir Putin's internally repressive and externally invasive policies. That factor is extremely low price of human life in Russia. I'm not so much talking about conventional economic value on which insurance companies operate, although money does play a role. I'm talking about the combination of civil rights and dignity that gives rise to the idea of self-worth and inviolability of the individual. I'm talking about the symbolic, but at the same time very real value of life, which is expressed, among other things, in the institutions of law, in the institution of independent court, and in the way the state protects the lives of the people, for example, in extreme situations. Metaphorically speaking, Vladimir Putin has now a supply of these cheap lives, which Russian command can spend paying them for kilometers of advance deep into the Ukrainian territory. It is these lives, not just shells, equipment, fuel, and money, that are the main currency of this war. Yes, now money is also at stake. Those who sign a contract with the Ministry of Defense can receive a sum maximum at about 50,000 euros. This is a huge amount of money for the Russian province, but the very fact that the lives of citizens can be bought for a certain price showed that these lives have no symbolic, immutable, dignity-related value. Everything is determined by demand and the structure of the war market. Where does this scarcity, this devaluation of existence come from? Without seeking excuses, without trying to rationalize Russian aggression, I still want to understand the question posed, because it has a direct bearing on the political future of Russia. I will focus on three pillars of Putin's new empire, the most important ones from my point of view: impunity, militarism, and chauvinism. Impunity. What is the most horrible about the Soviet project from the perspective we are discussing? It is the monstrous, senseless, criminal waste of human life, which reached such a scale that the life was devalued. I am not just talking about Stalin's repressions and deportations of entire people, of entire nations, mass shooting, arrests, and the Gulag. The very atmosphere of unfreedom, subjugation, suppression of natural vital interests, destruction of diversity, is also a murder. And it is not by chance that even in Russia in August and December 1991, no one really came out to defend the USSR. No one went to the barricades. Most people, it seems to me, had the feeling that it was impossible to live like this, at least in a purely material, utilitarian sense. But how can this notion of value of individual life can be recovered, restored, regrown, and made effective in politics? At the very least, it is necessary to recognize the problem in its entirety, to diagnose it and propose remedies. This has not been done in the case of Russia. Intellectually and anthropologically, Russian liberals were not prepared to understand what the totalitarian legacy is, what power it has, and why the task of restoring violated human dignity and the rule of law and the human rights was a momentous importance for Russia, the center of empire for many centuries. To put it crudely, the bet was on the notorious invisible hand of market. Push the country into the market relations as quickly as possible, and the market will do everything itself. The market will re-educate people, the market will give birth to a new man, an idea very much in the spirit of early Soviet re-education projects. The problem is that if the market itself produces values, there are material values. The market, especially in the form of wild capitalism as it existed in Russia at the time, is not a fertile ground for the growth of civil rights. There was a hope, I remember this motif very well in public discussion, that the class of owners was about to emerge, and this owners, small and large, would become a new political class. Property will give rise to the rights. Property will give rise to dignity. As we can now see, this hope was extremely naive. And it seems to me that the main political question of the transition to the state, based on the rule of law, the question without the solution of which the transition could not take place from the very beginning, was the question of legal and moral responsibility for the numerous and systematic crimes of the Soviet state. The only way to restore the value of the individual life, civil rights and dignity, was to act in two ways: to commemorate the victims, to bring them back from their oblivion, and this is an extremely important end, to punish the criminals who committed these crimes, to punish them by the legal means, thus restoring the rule of law and stating unequivocally that a human life is indeed invaluable. If justice is not done, any remembrance remains in the air. It does not change the structure of the society. It does not tangibly, visibly prove that the value of human life is an active political value. But what happened in Russia? The question of justice and responsibility was simply pushed aside and replaced by a war concept of repentance, which does not require legal action. Even the most and best liberal minds somehow avoided it, focusing more on memorialization. Some may argue that legal punishment is not an unconditional part of the transition to freedom, pointing to Spain, for example. But the thing is that Spain's relapse to tyranny would have been primarily danger to Spain itself. Russia falling back to the tyranny and de facto questioning revising the dissolution of the Soviet Union, such Russia is a threat to the whole world. I see the clear connection between the impunity of the Soviet crimes and criminals and Russia's aggression against Ukraine. A country where the crimes of the past go unpunished is an easy prey for the next dictator, precisely because the value of a human life as a public good has not been restored and protected. And so the ground is prepared for the next abuse of power. At best, such society would be guided by the individual survival strategy, where a person values his own life, but not the lives of others. It is a great pity that Russian opposition has never really made Putin's responsibility for aggressive wars the main accusation against him, preferring to focus on corruption in order to gain popular support. The rise of militarism has not been sufficiently recognized because of this. But where does the today's Russian militarism come from? Where are its roots? Or, to put it another way, what fuels or drives it? I would dare to suggest that it's not just the crazy wheel of Vladimir Putin and his entourage. The origin is somehow embedded in the very political system of the Russian Federation. What is now Russia is actually a conglomerate of nations that were conquered and subjugated in a different historical periods. Some quite recently, in the middle of the 19th century. Under Soviet rule, the larger ones were given quasi-political subjectivity in the form of autonomous republics. More than 30 years ago, one of these republics claims independence. It was Chechnya. The Chechens were brutally conquered in the 19th century, and the history of the brutal conquest remains a blank spot in Russian public conscience. In 1944, the whole nation was deported to Kazakhstan with enormous population losses. Quite a record, one might say, quite a pattern to prove and explain the claim of independence. First, Russia tried to overthrow the Chechen government by sending troops with no insignia, pretending to be opposition. Then, in December 1994, came a full-scale army assault. The operation was planned to be short and victorious. Russian generals did not believe they would meet resistance. As we all know, the operation had grown into big war, into punishing campaign against rebellious nation. Destroyed cities and facilities, use of heavy weapons to scare the population and force into submission, mass crimes against civilians. All that we see now in Ukraine was already a reality 30 years ago. Simply put, the Russian government under Yeltsin had sent an example for other potential candidates. No one goes, everyone stays. One can discuss the general legal framework, the international law that prevents separatism and gives central governments the power to respond. But the law cannot eliminate reality. And the reality is that the question of the right of nations to self-determination is one of the key questions for the future of Russia. It will always be on the table